Welcome to the award winners edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us today. We begin today's show with Sarah Kagan, a professor of gerontological nursing at the University of Pennsylvania. Her work examining the best practices in nursing and end-of-life care won her a MacArthur Fellowship back in 2003. She's the author of the book Older Adults Coping with Cancer, which is a reexamination of long-held practices in caring for the terminally ill. She joined us in our studio to discuss her work, her award, and to fill us in on her thoughts about the best way to provide medical treatment in a time of nursing shortages and an overabundance of medical technology. Let's take a listen. How do you define good bedside manner?
I have sort of an odd conception of that, in the sense that I think we should be the clinicians our patients need us to be. That is to say, within your personal style as a doctor or a nurse, if your patient needs you to be a coach, or if your patient needs you to be an informant or an educator, we should try to do that within the realm of our personal knowledge and our personal professional expertise. When you start out as a student, there are very big hurdles to face in learning therapeutic communication.
Right.
But as we go through our careers, we aren't static beings, and we have the opportunity to learn new skills and new tips. And I've been a nurse for 16 years. I now am able to say, well, you know, my patients have really taught me. I couldn't say that when I first started out.
Some have said, Sarah, that the time and technology have made it perhaps harder for some doctors, nurses to give care. I mean, you have all these machines around. It's so easy to focus on the machine and not on the patient, or there's just so little time that can make it hard as well.
That's certainly true. And one of the things to consider is that we really have to put the technology in the background in order to focus on the patient. And so that takes a certain amount of skill. You have to learn how to use the machines. You have to learn how to use the technology that's in front of you. But the other piece of it is to talk yourself into it. That is to say, I have this amount of time, and to be very focused, rather than saying, I have no time, which tends to put you in this situation of, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? A classic situation is when a staff nurse feels as though she and a patient can't quite get it right, and they're spending a lot of time going around in a circle. And that tends to be because either the technology is in the forefront, and the patient and the nurse and the doctor are all worried about it, or that there hasn't really been an alignment of, hey, we have time and a job to do, so let's try to focus our agenda and kind of share some goals. And so getting common goals right is a good thing to do.
Well, but it also seems that nurses have a kind of more ongoing relationship with patients, especially patients who have been hospitalized. They literally put in more time than the doctors do.
Certainly. In fact, if you're in the hospital, you're going to be with a nurse for the greater part of every 24-hour period, every day. There is sort of disease and everything that goes with it, and there's healing, which is a distinctly different sort of thing. And healing is in large part, particularly depending on how ill you really are, healing is often a very hard-won team effort that starts with the patient, because patients have to want to know their health, know their what will heal them, and to have some sense of being a member of the team. And so when we, as nurses, doctors, and other health professionals like physical therapists, don't communicate, we tend to close ourselves out of knowing how that patient approaches health and healing. Hmm. But we also, I think, then make ourselves work a whole lot harder, because we've still got the same job to do. It's just that we don't have the inside track on the spiritual or personal or whatever you want to call it piece of healing is there that will help us do our jobs better. And so in education, we can really start by having students consider what is it that they know about themselves, what have they seen with their own family members, clarifying their what they value about health and healing in order to go forward.
Yeah. What about touching a patient? Is that important to communication, Sarah?
I think it's really important, in the sense that all of us have very different ideas of how touch conveys emotion, some kind of feeling. And touch can be seen as very supportive or very intrusive. And nursing is a very intimate profession. Particularly in hospitals, we help patients do the things they can't do for themselves. And that can be just about everything. And so as a result, you have to spend time really listening and reading nonverbal behavior. You know, when your patient can't talk, you've got to be able to look at gestures and get a sense, is this okay, is this not okay? And I spend a lot of time explaining what I'm going to do and then stopping and saying, is this okay? Do you understand what I said? Doing a double check is really important, whether it's touch or something else that's more procedural, you know, something you're going to do to the patient.
For a lot of patients, they don't feel, for whatever reason, sort of entitled to ask questions. They don't know how to ask questions, even might feel intimidated by saying, look, can you speak in English to me about what's going on here? Just, I think as you feel sick, you don't feel like you can be yourself in a way.
Appoint a friend or a family member as your mouthpiece, your voice, if you can't speak. That's an important piece because sometimes any of us, even doctors or nurses, are too shy to say, this is really bothering me. Mm-hmm. So if you can bring someone with you, or if you're in the hospital, have that person sort of designated as your voice, your mouthpiece.
Because active listening is hard on the patient's part.
You know, that's a very good point. And I have worked with a number of physicians who actually ask their patients and family members to bring in tape recorders. I'm thinking of a couple of oncologists, doctors who specialize in cancer treatment. Other physicians and nurse practitioners are concerned about medical legal sorts of things, creating a separate record, separate from your chart, if you will, on these recordings. And we could have a discussion about that I don't think is worthwhile. I do think the point that you're making about finding a way to record information is really important. So I spend a lot of time working with older adults who have cancer, and I almost invariably recommend that they always have someone else go with them to their doctor's appointments and bring a pad of paper, preferably a notebook, so that each day you can just make an entry. So on each appointment, you have your notes, and you can go back and you can say, help me figure this out, or we said this sort of thing last time, what should we do about it this time? Something to do when you're looking for a primary healthcare provider, is there a number of them out there in different specialties. When you're looking for a primary healthcare provider, figure out, make a list of the things that are important to you. If solo practice is one of them, that's something to go for. Also think about the style of the doctor or nurse practitioner you're looking for. Do you like more authoritative, paternalistic, collegial? There are a whole lot of different styles that you can choose from now. And you should interview your primary health care provider when you're not sick, when you're looking to stay well.
What about difficult patients? When patients are either uncooperative or hostile, I'm just thinking of all the variations of a difficult patient. How do you suggest doctors deal with that?
I think that a couple of things occur to me. I try to avoid the language of difficult, and it gets us back then to what's the problem at hand. So when I'm talking with my students or nursing colleagues, one of the first things to recognize, and this is taught in some nursing schools, and I always like to debunk the myth, you don't have to like all your patients because not all of your patients are going to like you. It's a two-way street. This is very much a two-way street, but we still have a job to do. And when things go wrong and there are behaviors, whether it's anger or hostility or outright physical abuse, if you set limits on what the behavior is and what's appropriate in that setting, and then backtrack to why are we here, and say to the patient and family, because family are often a part of what patients are bringing to the hospital. We all have our own family dynamics and all sorts of other issues that predate any kind of healthcare interactions and will postdate them as well.
Right.
And so then you can say to the patient quite honestly, look, we're not getting along here and we're not getting the job done. What is it that you have on your mind that can help me understand how we can come together and get the job done?
Delivering bad news. And is that something that I mean, I'm assuming that's something that all doctors dread to do. It's, you know, got to be one of the more difficult conversations that they have to have. What advice do you give medical students?
I think the relationship piece is incredibly important in the sense that almost nothing, and for anyone who's had an seriously ill family member, we can all think back to the time of nothing blunts that terrible feeling of, oh my gosh, what does this mean for us? What does this mean for my life? What does this mean for the person I love? And I think that nursing has done that for quite a number of years, and it works really well. But there's nothing like getting in a room with a patient one-on-one and asking about either sex, death, or finances. I tend to think those are the three biggies where everyone goes, well, can I really do this? And part of what I think we do in translating what goes on in the classroom into the clinical arena is to offer mentorship and guidance, to get students in with clinicians who are already practicing and have them trade off asking those questions. They're always going to be difficult for certain people, mm-hmm. not so difficult for other people. And in critical situations, I'm also a big believer in getting the team together and saying, well, you know, we've really got to probe more deeply into what is this patient is thinking about on this topic. Maybe it's sex, maybe it's death, whatever it might be. In my world, it's much more death.
Right.
And then it's about who on the team has the best relationship to ask that question. I think that not everyone can be all things to all patients. And so in addition to having basic skills, you want to be able to say to a colleague who's got more expertise, hey, come on, let's try to go find out more about this. In addition to the relationship, you can often build in pieces of your own sort of experience, not disclosing so much that you give things away and that you're inappropriate, that you cross a boundary, but that you can say, look, this is tough. And I often will say, you know, both as a nurse and as a family member, I've experienced these things. Let me walk you through some things that I think you should do now. Because in addition to information, you often have to give a devastated family direction. Where do you go next? That is, no, you don't need to make decisions right now. You can just sit and have a glass of water and recover your sort of sense of yourselves in the next 30 minutes, and then we'll go back and talk about something else.
I assume you have to deal, though, with a lot of crying. Is that something you get used to, Sarah?
It's never – I don't think suffering is something that you can get used to. You can either distance yourself from it, or you can become so involved in it that it becomes unhealthy mm-hmm. for you as a clinician. I think that having your Kleenex available being realistic and saying, you know, it's a good thing that you're crying, and this is a lot to take in, so let's just take it in pieces, because I think over the years I've learned that people really appreciate honesty, mm-hmm. so that even if you give bad news, if it was given in a way that someone could hear it and it was turned out to be really honest and credible, most people find that that's something they rely on time and time again. And so when my patients think, particularly when they've been having a very bad time, that I'm sort of pulling their legs and being a cheerleader for no particular reason, I'll say, look, I'm always honest with you, even if it's bad news. But when I give you good news, I mean it.
That was my interview with University of Pennsylvania nursing expert Sarah Kagan, who won a MacArthur Fellowship back in 2003 for her work in reframing nursing practices. This is the award winner's edition of Radio Times in Review. And when we get back from the break, we'll hear from another MacArthur Fellow, Angela Duckworth, who'll tell us about grit. Stay with us. Welcome back to the award winners edition of Radio Times in Review. We're revisiting our conversations with guests who have received some of the highest accolades you can get. If you visit your local bookstore and walk back to the self-help section, you'll see lots of books devoted to becoming successful, to realizing your dreams and being your best self. The advice is often another way of saying, be determined. Psychologist Angela Duckworth, founder of the Duckworth Lab at the University of Pennsylvania, calls this grit. She won a 2013 MacArthur Fellowship for her work analyzing the effectiveness in grit and determining an individual's level of achievement. She joined me on the heels of winning her prestigious award to tell us about this trait and what life factors are responsible for someone's level of stick-to-itiveness. Let's take a listen. Tell us what you mean by grit.
By grit, I mean passion and perseverance for very long-term goals. And the reason I study grit is because gritty people tend to be the high achievers in society, whether that be in academics or in, you know, professional life. And I also study self-control, which is somewhat related but different. Self-control is the ability in the moment to resist temptations and distractions. And, you know, self-control people tend to be grittier on average, but you mm-hmm. find exceptions. You find some very gritty people who actually have a diagnosis of ADHD.
Well, and I wonder, because I know you worked for a couple of years as a teacher, whether it was being a teacher that you began to think of some of these ideas.
Absolutely. So as a classroom teacher, I taught math in middle school and high school settings for about 5 years total. And I would say that the singular observation that I have, and one that I couldn't shake, I was just puzzled by it, was the fact that kids who did really well in my class weren't always the brightest, at least by their test scores and IQ scores and so forth. And then I also found the opposite pattern, right? Some super high achievers who you look at their standardized, you know, IQ or achievement scores, and they're not fantastic or stellar. And I think what it came to me is that so much of accomplished in life, and I would just say that this is not only true in fourth grade or eighth grade, but just in life, is, you know, sustained high quality effort. And how do we get kids to have, you know, high quality time on task? And these characteristics, you know, grit and self-control really mm-hmm. enable you to do that.
Well, are we talking about just kids or all of us just trying harder, working harder, living up to our potential or our alleged potential?
Well, my 10-year-old daughter said to me once, just out of the blue, "Oh, mommy, I figured out what you do. You know, you're trying to get everybody in the world to work harder." And I thought that was roughly true. I mean, I do think so many of us could be doing more. I would say this, there are people who are working hard enough, and there are some people who maybe you could argue are working too hard, but they are in the minority. And I think for many of us, we're below our potential.
There are probably a small number of kids that need an extra amount of attention and care.
You know, as every classroom teacher knows, there is this kind of topography in the classroom where, yeah, most of the kids are on task and paying attention, but those two or three kids, you know, you don't really, it's not clear what you should do with them because on the one hand, if you ignore them, they really do disrupt the rest of the class. And that sort of seems unfair that they can suck up 85% of your attention, even though they're not 85% of the students. On the other hand, what if you didn't, right? And so how do we manage that? Some could also argue that the most ethical thing is to spend all of your time with them because they are the neediest in that mm-hmm. way. So I don't think there's a good answer. And I think what our work really emphasizes is, you know, to what extent could you develop strategies or run things in the class or in the school in ways that would really lift the tide for all of the boats, right? So that that at least, you know, you should have a reduced frequency of those things and you would be able to help those kids who are the neediest, but also at the same time, help the kids who are already at the top of the class.
And we're almost about a break here, but one of the things that you are finding out is that this grit idea is a teachable idea.
You know, everything
people can learn this.
People often ask me, "Oh, well, character is taught, but intelligence is innate." Everything psychologists study, including character and intelligence, is both.
It's both taught and innate.
That's right.
I know you're doing some work with some schools in the area, including Upper Darby, Cherry Hill, other places as well. When you're talking about teaching, you know, grit or teaching self-control, how do you do that? What does it look like?
Well, I should first say that, you know, we're just at the beginning, right? So if behavior change is the, you know, new frontier possibly for the 21st century, and I guess that's my biased view, we're just at the beginning of that work. But I will say this. I mean, the basic idea is that there are strategies people can use that don't depend on, you know, better myelination of the frontal cortex or anything that changes your genes, just strategies that you can use to fare better in situations where, for example, in self-control, you're conflicted between a temptation that feels really good right now, you know, Facebook, chocolate frosted donuts, you know, whatever it is for
all
you.
All of that.
They're all good. They all feel great. Or versus, you know, whatever, your homework, the salad, you know, taking a walk instead of sitting on the couch. So strategies, I think the best way to think about strategies is, first of all, thinking about the Greek root, which is strategia. That is the Greek root of the English word strategy, and that translates roughly to military general. And I think the idea is, you know, given the same resources, the same number of soldiers, and the same number of, you know, tools, what could you do that's just more clever? So, for example, if self-control is an issue for you and you can't stop going on Facebook and, mm-hmm. you know, you find that it's 10 o'clock at night before you started your homework, are there ways that you can physically change your situation, put your cell phone in a drawer so you don't see it, you know, put it on involved. My daughter, actually, my 10-year-old said she heard me lecturing, actually, about this topic. She turned her cell phone off. And just that kind of 15-second delay while you have to wait for your cell phone to power up kind of took the allure out of texting. And she said to me the other day, she's like, you know, I haven't even used my cell phone in 3 days. Is this because I'm kind of, you know, too lazy to turn it on? So that kind of strategy, hiding the Halloween candy, all those things that I think a lot of us have picked up over time, those might be strategies that are teachable to kids who don't come upon them spontaneously.
Well, it's interesting because it feels like, I don't know if it's true or not, that we live in a very distractible world. I mean, it seems there are so many shiny objects that want our attention.
That's right. I mean, you know, you don't have to go very far to look to see the philosophical or the religious quotes, lead me not into temptation. You know, Aristotle, Plato, you know, they all wrote about this conflict, Freud. But what might be different, I would argue, in the 21st century is that, you know, Madison Avenue and Silicon Valley have gotten very good at tempting us. And, you know, things taste really good. They're fun. They're just so many diversions. Mm-hmm. And they're, I think, arguably more potent than they have ever been.
And when we think about grid, I mean, I think about it as a kind of stick-to-itiveness. The idea is that I'm gonna work my way through this issue or through this problem. But you have to feel connected or some kind of passion about what you're doing too.
Absolutely. So grit is not just, you know, sticking with things, although of course that's an important part of it. There has to be something to which you are sticking, you know, mm-hmm. some guiding north star for you. And I think that's a really important point to make, because I don't want parents or teachers to come away from this and kind of just oppress their children into doing things and working hard. The kids have to really care, and that's part of the challenge of grit. Mm-hmm. Finding things that you are really interested in, and I will just add that it's not just discovering things. It's kind of like falling in love. There's some work there, too. There's some work there to mature your interest, to go deeper. And that's not always just kind of something that happens to you.
But it's interesting to think about, you know, grit and how that applies to something like unresolved drama.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, our lab has undertaken this kind of work. We actually administered to several large samples of children, you know, just we call it the negative life events inventory, and it is just this count list of, you know, my parents are fighting a lot, my parents got divorced, there's been violence in the home, I saw somebody get shot, you know, my best friend moved away. And you simply count up the number of events that children report experiencing in the previous 6 months. You can then in turn predict how less self-controlled they'll be, so they fall in self-control as a function of these negative life events. And actually, it's so large, this effect, that you don't need kind of really mm-hmm. sensitive laboratory measures. Teachers, who are, of course, blind often to these internal family issues, will note measurable changes in students' behavior and the decrease in those behaviors that are positive and the increase in behaviors that are negative mm-hmm. over time.
And this is about self – I mean, if you feel as if you're just dealing with so many conflicts – how do you control yourself, right?
So there are multiple possible reasons why this might be the case. One possibility that's been argued recently is that when you are dealing with a lot of things that are urgent and require your attention, you just have fewer cognitive resources to now control yourself, and that's why you're more impulsive. Right. Alternatively, there's an evolutionary explanation for this, which says if you find yourself in an environment which is uncertain and threatening, the adaptive thing to do is to be reactive, go mm-hmm. with your first impulse, you know, suspend reflection, metacognition, and just go. And I think that's another explanation, which is sort of separate from like, well, you just can't do it because you mm-hmm. don't have enough resources. And there may be others. But I think this kind of recent development where we're looking at adverse events in people's lives and seeing its effects not only on the body but on the mind, and of course those are connected, that's a really promising way, a new way of thinking of looking at poverty.
As I realize you're in the beginning of some of this research about in terms of applying it to schools, where would you like to take it? I mean, where are you going with some of these ideas?
Yeah, well, we think that, as Jeffrey was pointing out, it's hard to undo, you know, 30 years of bad choices. And I think that is what draws me to children and to schools, because it's earlier in this narrative. And so often you find that there are either vicious or virtuous cycles, you know, depending which tide pool you actually end up in. So we're hoping to get kids into more virtuous cycles. Our work in particular focuses on middle school kids, so starting around the age of 10 or 11 years old. I find that a particularly interesting age group, in part because it's before the onslaught of adolescent hormones, and it's just very hard to work with teenagers and get them to, you know, encode a totally new message when they are, frankly, concerned with other things.
Sure.
And the other reason, I think, is because a lot of kids are actually now making the transition between elementary school to middle school just at that juncture. And that tends to be a point in time where kids will diverge in their trajectories. And for some kids, it actually is the beginning of a vicious cycle of school disengagement, of sort of not feeling part of the group, and, you know, then impulsivity, and then kind of just going downward. So we are looking at school-based interventions. We're thinking that that would be the way to scale. It's not that we don't think parents are important. They're obviously important. I believe that strongly as a parent myself of a 10- and 12-year-old. But it's unclear to me how I would reach, you know, thousands, if not more, parents, and whereas schools, you know, there's sort of a vector for that, if you will. I think in addition to kind of anything that we would test out and try and say, oh, in this random assignment study, we found an effect on self-control or grit, I think really the ultimate lever for change is to then teach teachers what we found and why deeply, right, not superficially, and see whether that might shift school practice and culture. Mm. It was only through that constant reinforcement, I think, that could you ever hope to get a long-term sustained effect on children's behavior.
Because you need, I mean, you need to engage children, obviously, in their academics and their courses. And if they're engaged in an interesting way, I'm assuming some of these features then will come out, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's often debated in policy circles whether this interest in character, or some people call it social-emotional right. learning, you know, whether this is actually going to threaten academic work. And to the contrary, my deep belief is that these things are mutually reinforcing. You simply can't learn very much when you cannot control your attention, your behavior, and emotion in school. And when you're doing well in school, it actually makes it easier for you to now, you know, allocate some of your energy towards these other things. So really, I think that these things go hand in hand. And so I think it's by introducing these skills, these strategies, and this understanding, maybe even just you could say this perspective into schooling, teachers who are the ultimate, you know, the ones who kind of have to carry this baton, mm-hmm. could really think about their work as both. So when you're teaching a math lesson, you know, how do we do this in a way that is clearly obviously emphasizes the math, but also is signaling to kids, you know, that self-control and grit are needed. And by the way, here's how you might actually exercise it a little better than you have been.
Are you concerned that schools and perhaps parents are too concerned about protecting their kids from failure?
Well, you know, I think it's a yuppie thing, right? The kind of bubble wrapping your kid. In fact, I think the Philadelphia Magazine had a picture of a kid like fully encased in bubble wrap. I found it very funny. It's, by the way, I think a very understandable impulse. As somebody who, you know, herself is sort of, you know, every nick and bruise and tear, you know, you just want the best for your kids. And I think that's true of all of us, you know, not just the, you know, one socioeconomic stratum sure. or another. Now, the challenge is, I mean, as Nietzsche told us, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I mean, every parent is worried about what would actually kill the kid. I mean, you know, it's very, very hard to make those decisions in life, I think, as a teacher or a parent. I would say this, that children are like adults. They adapt to their circumstances. And if you create a friction-free circumstance for your child, that's what they will adapt to. If you wonder, like, why can't you make a piece of toast, or, you know, how can you not, you know, bounce back after just getting a B-? Well, if that's the environment to which they've adapted, we shouldn't be surprised.
Hmm. Have you, Angela, looked at autism and how that might apply to the work you've been doing?
We haven't looked at autism or kids who you would say were on the spectrum, right, for autistic symptomology, nor have we specifically looked at post-traumatic growth. But I think the caller's, you know, making, you know, important points. So whatever the kind of adversity it is, you know, to look at how people have really, in a way, rationally adapted, mm-hmm. even if it's not – it's maladaptive really, but there's some kind of, you know, understandable way that they've been adapting to their circumstances.
And you're talking about applying the data. I mean, getting the data and then – using it in the classroom.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's, of course, a challenge and easier said than done. But, you know, let's see how far we can get if we try it. Right. And I think it is a cultural shift, right, so that we can, you know, in countries like Finland, teachers consider themselves, all of them, not just a small number of them, they're all researchers, they're all scientists, they're all trying to figure out, you know, what if I did this? You know, and then I measured the change in my practice, what would happen, and can I, in a more rigorous way, you know, sort of look at that? And I think that that would be the greater hope from, you know, nothing that my own little lab does or even my lab plus its collaborators, but really to have a shift in the educational culture to say, you know, these questions are amenable to the scientific method and to the technological innovation cycles, you know, rapid prototyping, measuring, going right back, you know, with just enough data, going back again, version 2.0, version 3.0 and up. That would be the major, I think, win for education.
When you talk about grid, is that also related to resilience? I mean, it's how some people, for whatever reason, they get knocked down, they get up and they keep going.
Yeah, different people define resilience in different ways, but I think one very common definition is coming back from adversity, and that's absolutely part of grit. And that's why certain questions on the grit scale have to do with coming back after setbacks and disappointment. But there are other questions, too, which don't have to do with that and have to do with really having sustained commitments or interests over time. And I guess, it's not just resilience. So we're interested in particular in what are the antecedents of grit. So grit's great, but, you know, how do you get more of it?
Right.
And, you know, we find a pattern in our data that people who truly do have hope, so we would call it optimistic explanatory style, when something bad happens, do you spontaneously think about causes, if it's a bad event, that are specific and changeable as opposed to global and permanent? And those people who are more optimistic, who can reach and say, this was a total disaster, but, you know, this specific cause can be remediated. Those are the people who, of course, you know, try harder. So I think grit does derive in part from this optimistic mindset. And the other pattern, I think it's very similar, is people have a growth mindset, people who believe that human nature is fundamentally changeable and that the way things are aren't necessarily the way things are going to be. Right. Those people also are more gritty.
Well, and that's optimism, too, isn't it? That things will, I mean, it's evolution, but it's optimism as well.
Yeah, and it's hard, actually. I have to say, I'm somebody who knows that that's true, and I'm becoming more of a growth mindset person, but it's so very easy to dwell on the way things are and just to feel like they're just going to be that way forever.
That was my conversation with psychologist Angela Duckworth, founder of the Duckworth Lab at the University of Pennsylvania, who joined us to discuss grit. This is the award winners edition of Radio Times in Review. And when we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with Princeton University professor Angus Deaton, who won a Nobel Prize earlier this year. Stay with us. This is the award winners edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We continue our show today highlighting my conversations with guests who have won some of the most revered honors. And now we turn to Angus Deaton. The Princeton University economics professor won a Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences earlier this year for his analysis of poverty and how it relates to welfare and consumption. In an age of increasing income inequality, Deaton says this disparity is posing a serious threat to the world's economy and the way national and international politics will be organized in the future. He joined me last month to discuss what he found. Let's listen. Well, let me ask you about some of the things that you have done, and one of them is to focus on consumption. And this, I guess, was early on in your career, such as it is. Why consumption? What were you interested in trying to understand?
Okay. Well, again, it's very similar to the story I just told you about the mouse. I mean, I got this job as a research assistant in Cambridge, and there was a wonderful person there who became my mentor, a man called Richard Stone, who won the Nobel Prize in 1984 and who'd actually worked with Keynes and others in building the British National Accounts during the war. And he had always been interested in consumption. So I looked at the person that I wanted to be most like, and I thought, okay, I'll study that too. And he was very willing to have me work with him, and he befriended me very early on. I was never a student or, you know, he made me feel like a full collaborator from the beginning. Mm. And so I started doing what I do, which is, you know, trying to tinker with things, trying to make things better. And, you know, come up with something that worked better than what we had, or that, you know, I could compute more easily, or that I had better data for. And so I always think of what I'm doing as this sort of tinkering. But in the end, you know, you've got something that looks like this amazing new machine, and then the Nobel Committee comes along and says, look what you did. And I sort of think, okay, well, I started with a lot of stuff, and yeah, a lot of other people had worked on it, and I sort of played with it, and maybe, you know, I made it gleam a little more or a little slicker. And almost everything I've done, whether it's development economics or poverty or inequality, has been I was working on something close by, good people were asking difficult questions. Sometimes impossible questions, but, you know, I've had a lot of contact over the years with the World Bank, and the World Bank's a terrific place because they have problems, real problems. And one of the dangers of an academic is that you finish up just doing what other academics do instead of trying to address bigger problems that people really care about. I try to do that.
Well, let me pick up on the consumption part, and I'm assuming what you're talking about is just literally how people spend money, what they spend money on. I mean, is it – I don't mean to in any way uncomplicate what you've been studying, but is that it's sort of how people behave based on the kind of access to money that they have?
Yes. So that's exactly right. And it's – one way I put it is it's sort of studying what makes people tick, and this is one particular dimension, which is how they spend their money. And how do they do as well for themselves as they can while spending that money? So that's part of it. Their well-being is, you know, part of the story. But it's also it's up to policy because a big thing that influences what they spend is the prices of things. And, you know, the prices of things can be altered by government policy, for example, by putting taxes on or subsidies or import duties and things like that. So there's a lot of practical policy issues which, like the Congressional Budget Office, needs to know, which is when you change prices, you know, how will things change? There's another part of that which is probably more important, which is, you know, part of consumption is what people don't consume. And what you don't consume, you save. And saving is, you know, the essence of what is going to protect you in your old age, for instance, when, you know, you can't work anymore or you don't want to work anymore.
Exactly.
And so, you know, the saving consumption decision, as we think of it, has been a central issue in economics forever. And I spend a lot of time working on that, too.
Well, we are, as you well know, you know, a country that really depends on consumption. I think something like 70% of our economy is based on people buying things. Does that worry you if we're talking about consumption and saving?
Well, it's certainly been a problem in the past. I think we've been overcome with other things since the financial crisis. But, you know, one of the big puzzles was just how little Americans saved, whereas countries like China are saving an enormous share. And then that's a real worry for whether people will have enough to retire on, or if they do have enough to retire on, whether the government will be able to have a solvent Social Security scheme. And all those issues are to do with saving and consumption and spending.
Do you think an economy like the U.S. economy, that that's sort of the right way to do economics, which is really to rely largely on people buying things?
As opposed to what?
Well, maybe China? I don't know.
Well, the Chinese like to buy things too. And, you know, part of what's happening in China is their incomes are growing so fast that they can keep on buying what they want and buying more and more every year and still have a lot left over to save. So unfortunately, that option is not really open to Americans.
I was doing a little bit of reading on a joint research project that you're doing, finding an increase in middle-aged mortality in the United States. Can you flesh that out for us? What are you finding?
Yeah, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible thing. And I think we almost fell off our chairs when we found it. And, you know, we didn't make this up or collect the data ourselves. I mean, these are official U.S. government data. So there has been this big rise in mortality of Americans in middle age. And it's only white Americans. It's not happening to African Americans or to Hispanics. It's not happening in any other rich country around the world. All those countries, you just see this mortality rate falling like it has for the last 30 or 40 years. And so one might ask what it is. Yeah. It turns out a lot of it is drug addiction. And people are dying of overdoses. They're dying of alcohol overdoses. They're dying of overdoses of illegal drugs like heroin. And they're dying of overdoses of prescription drugs like OxyContin, for example. There's also been a huge increase in suicides in this age group and a big increase in people dying of liver disease or of cirrhosis of the liver. And it's accompanied by an epidemic of pain and morbidity that goes with the mortality. So it's a really terrifying thing.
Is it related, do you think, to the recession? And are we talking about white men and women?
White men and women. It can't be. I mean, I'm sure the recession didn't help, but this started from 1998, and it's been going on for at least 15 years now. So the recession can't have been the immediate cause of it. One possibility is that it's much more to do with the very slow economic growth that many of these people have experienced throughout their lives compared with, say, their parents. So these are people who in their 40s and 50s are discovering that their dreams of being richer than their parents are never going to happen. It's much worse among people who only have a high school degree or less, and much less severe, though you see some of it, among people who have some college or college degrees.
I mean, it sounds like some kind of a public health crisis.
I think it is. And we calculate the number of people who died is a little less, but comparable to the number of people who died from HIV/AIDS. So, and yet this has had almost no attention. The drug addiction problem and the deaths from overdoses is pretty well understood. But the broader dimensions of it seem to have escaped a lot of public attention. We're very excited about this work and wish it were cheerier.
Well, indeed, but certainly very important, and hopefully someone in government somewhere will take a look at this and, I guess, do something with the data. And I guess as an economist that looks at data, that's what you want, right?
Very much so. We want just a lot more public attention to this and, you know, not think of it as purely a drug. I mean, we've been calling it an epidemic of despair. And, you know, that's a dramatic phrase to emphasize what we think. I mean, it's not something you would really back up with data. But there's a lot of bad stuff going on. I mean, there's a huge epidemic of lower back pain, for instance. And lower back pain is incredibly hard to deal with. Doctors are just not very good at dealing with it. And it's one of these things, if you have, there's often very little hope. I mean, people have been through the medical system every which way. They do Eastern medicine, Western medicine, and they still live with that pain. And pain is a very, very hard thing to live with.
Yes, it is. You look at data. I mean, that's part of what you do, and part of it is looking at the information that you get and then drawing your conclusions from that. But I'm thinking, especially if you're asking people about their own lives, people can sometimes be imperfect about that or not, you know, not totally understand the question. They might not be truthful or not. How do you weigh that? How do you gauge or deal with that?
Well, you always have to make allowances for that. So you're absolutely right. And sometimes the data are very hard and there's not much doubt. Like if we sort of know whether someone's dead or alive. You know, that's not very controversial. And you and I talked once before about, you know, if you ask people how happy they are, there's a lot of questions about what that means and, you know, whether you'll get the same answer when you ask them tomorrow and so on. But a lot of what I do is try to triangulate things. So if you're suspicious of a number, you may have another version of that number from somewhere else. And you can sort of track them down and see if they match up or not. And in fact, some of the most difficult stuff I've worked on, difficult in the sense that I've no idea how to resolve it, are things like measuring poverty in India, where, you know, you see this enormous rate of growth of GDP in India, which the Indians are justly very proud of. But at the same time, there's much less poverty reduction than you would expect given that enormous rate of growth. And you might say, okay, it's like the United States. All this money is going to the rich people and very little is going to the poor. But that's not true either. And what it is just huge statistical discrepancies. The numbers don't add up. And that's very frustrating.
You mentioned income inequality. Is that a real phenomenon here in the United States, the growing gap
Yes.
between the rich and the poor?
Yes. You can – one of the things that's sort of interesting is to watch the press. Of course, you can – there's no single concept of inequality. It's sort of – one metaphor I like to use is there's a very broad river of people's incomes in the national economy, and they're sort of more or less going along together, but some are going faster than other bits. And how much inequality you'll see, which is sort of gaps between people, will depend on just which part of the river you're looking at. So, you know, there's been a lot of right-left stuff with the left saying, look, this horrible increase in inequality among group X. And then on the right say, well, if you look at it this way, there's really been very little increase in inequality at all. But I think we're in a situation now where we know that there's a tremendous amount of widening of opening up of gaps between different groups of people. And that, for me, I've thought about inequality my whole life, and it's just enormously encouraging that it's become a serious center of debate, which it really has not been.
Is income inequality, though, bad for a country? If we're talking about the United States, is it bad for this country to have such a divide?
Well, it's a bit like asking, is weather bad for a country, you know?
Well, it doesn't have to. We don't have to have this level of income inequality, do we?
I don't know. I mean, in what sense? I mean, if you say we don't have to, you'd have to give me a specific policy and then ask whether that policy is feasible. So,
well, like a tax policy, for instance, you know, that.
Absolutely. So there's no doubt about that. We could design a tax policy which would make that inequality much less. So you're talking about the sort of engineering feasibility, right. But do you think that's politically feasible?
Probably not.
So that's the sort of question I'm asking. I mean, do we have to have it? Well, given the way the country is right now, many of the policies that you would think might do better will be very difficult to implement. On the other hand, you know, there are good parts about inequality too, but I think I'm in line with what you implied at least, that I think right now the dangers are from having too much, mm-hmm. not from having too little.
What's the good side of income inequality since you raised it?
Well, in my book, The Great Escape, I talk about it's called Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality. And one of the important origins of inequality is just the world becoming a better place. So, you know, perhaps the greatest example of this is when, you know, the mid-18th, 19th centuries, Northwest Europe, you had the Industrial Revolution, the Health Revolution that went with it, which increased life expectancy and per capita income in Britain and Holland and other countries in Northwest Europe and the United States. So, you know, it's hard to think that's a bad thing. That didn't hurt other people in the world. So, but it generated an enormous amount of inequality because this didn't happen in India, it didn't happen in Africa, it didn't happen in Latin America in the first instance. So, you know, and someone invents a new drug, maybe some people get it before other people, big mm-hmm. amount of inequality. So that opening up of inequality is a consequence of progress, and we wouldn't want to choke off progress in order to stop there being any inequality.
Again, that was my conversation with Princeton University professor and Nobel Prize winner Angus Deaton. And that wraps up the award winners edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edited this show with the help of our intern, Diana Allen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.